Today, an encore interview with the late, great folk music extraordinaire, Richie Havens.
I'm on location today in the Big Apple, New York City. I'm privileged to have as my guest a man who has one of the most recognizable voices in popular music. My guest, Richie Havens. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Hello, my pleasure, for sure.
Very good. I want to do this. I want to take our audience back to your growing up.
Sure.
And
sure.
I can't pronounce the name. Bedford?
Bedford Stuyvesant.
Yes.
Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
Yes.
And this program is carried by an affiliate in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
So their native song.
All my family will be listening.
Absolutely.
All my brothers and sisters still live there.
Want to make sure that they're listening. Yeah. I want you to talk to us about growing up. Describe the neighborhood that you grew up.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, as a young person, I was born in 1941, so I sort of grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant through the 40s, into the 50s, well, actually almost into the 60s, but really into the 50s. And growing up in Bed-Stuyvesant at that time was a very special thing, I believe, because I don't think that many people in this country have had the experience of growing up that particular way, considering that the East Coast of the United States was pretty much the place where most people entered this country from other places, including my grandmother, who came from Barbados, and my grandfather, my mother's mother and father, came from the islands. My father's people were Native Americans, so they came from the country, but not basically the East Coast. They were actually North South Dakota people, Blackfoot Indian. So growing up in Brooklyn, for me, was very special because it, in fact, was a brand new world. My parents and my grandparents had not any thoughts about what was going to happen to this place after World War II. What has happened to it. In their minds, the world is getting better. In my mind, the world never was bad at that point. It turns out my friends, basically I grew up with people that came from all over the world. And I think that was part of the special character of it, is growing up with people from all over the world. You learn at a very young age, nobody's any different than anybody else.
I'm curious, my station is conducting a radio documentary entitled Women in Congress. We're taking a look at all of the women, majority women who have come through and made an impact on the nation through the congressional process. One lady in particular I'd like for you to talk to our audience about, if in fact you ran across her, Shirley Chisholm.
Oh, well, I've done a lot of different things with Shirley Chisholm, a lot of different benefits and different dinners that are honoring people for doing good things. I think, you know, that she had that special kind of spirit that came out of, I think, being born in Brooklyn, I'll tell you the honest truth, because of its special experience. And there's a certain kind of expectation that comes along with that, that things do have a destiny to become either corrected or correct, you know, or they should be allowed to be as correct as they actually are. And this is the field in which I think many of us who grew up in Brooklyn basically lived in the expectation of niceness, whatever you want to call it, expectation of opportunity for all, expectation of the American dream as defined by its original creators, you know, everybody having the opportunity. My grandmother owned her own home in 1930s. So, you know, for me to see the world through those eyes, and then to see by the 1950s my neighborhood changed because of civil rights, which is a very interesting story. I got to see both sides of the fence in a very different parts of my life and got to understand what we were not yet as America.
You're speaking of the American dream, just picking up on that a little bit. You do a great deal of positive things for youth. In the 1970s, you co-founded North Winds Undersea Institute and Oceanographic Museum for Children on City Island in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. You've done other things to get the youth stimulated. Why is it so important to you?
I think it's not even actually to get them stimulated, but to actually create a window or a doorway through which that stimulation that they already have can be expressed. Because I think that the youth are already beyond us. They're already living in a different world than we are, just like I was living in a different world and my parents was when I was a young person. Youth is always in a different world, and I think that we have to come to respect that world. It has just as much of a fabric of reality as the one we think we're living in. And I dare to say that the one we think we're living in isn't even what we think it is. So I think that the potential world that children live in is the real world.
Well, let's talk about the real world. Mm-hmm. They live in a world as well as we, mm-hmm. Where there's shocking crime rate. There's mm-hmm. unemployment across the board. Many critics of the recently signed welfare bill say that upwardly 1 million children could be thrown into poverty. Mm-hmm. Where's the silver lining in all of that to youth? Or do you think they're able to see a silver lining?
Well, you know something, interestingly enough, youth don't see things like that. Basically, growing up when I was young, my parents had to be on welfare a couple of times themselves, you know, in the sense of taking advantage of helping yourself through a specific time. And I think most people do it that way. I don't think most people want to be in a state of need all their lives. But I think that the system which we live under, which many of us believed was a certain kind of way and came to know it not to be so, and many others grew up knowing it not to be so in the first place, which is what our case is. America is very interesting in that we have people who grew up here as Americans under different defined and established senses of what America is, you know. I think that what we're going through now is really coming to grips with all of the problems we've always had. And I think that what we don't realize now is that the problems we've had that are still the same today are actually better than they were when we originally had them. Because we have many more people today than we had in the past as a nation. That stresses our senses and our abilities to live up to what we believe this is really supposed to be, because nobody in the government is even showing an inkling of what it really is supposed to be. So the people have to do this themselves. And we, you know, a lot of times it's called charity. A lot of times it's called lending a hand. But really it's survival. As far as I'm concerned, we're surviving together in a much better way than we've ever survived together, because we actually have to. A lot of time, that time between 1950, I would say, and 1980 maybe, there was a very nebulous world going on, in that people who were in the older generation said, where did our world go? The people who were in the midst of trying to create a better world were saying, are they going to let us do this? You know? And the young people who were watching everybody are saying, well, we better do our own or else there won't be any. And this is what we're living in. We're living in a stratified consciousness, and that's our problem. So for me to doing what I do, getting, you know, going around the world singing music to a lot of different kinds of people, I get to see, in a sense, the unstratified part of it, the common part of it, which is we are all the same.
Well, let me just ask, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. musically, could you describe America musically? Is that possible, do you think?
Musically? Yeah. You mean by a song?
Not necessarily by a song, but if you had to, just describe America, not in the total lyrical sense, uh-huh. but from a musical standpoint, would that be possible? Is that possible?
I think it's possible, but it would take several songs on several stratas, because we do see it differently. And yes, it can be done. A friend of mine and I were working on a play called America Inc., INC, which basically tried to do just that. And what it really turns out to describe is the conditions that we are all living under. And the misunderstanding and interpretation of what we actually see in front of our very own eyes, and the way we have been taught not to see the things that are natural. So that would be my description musically, is talking about those things. I would have to address those kinds of things, because we are not finished. We never were. The world has never been whole in its entire history. So we have to get off this wagon of we lost something we had and we are trying to fight to get it back. We never had it. It's as simple as that. And we have to come together now to prove that we can, in fact, have it, because it's going to take all of us to get it.
It's interesting. I'm going to quote our audience just an excerpt that you have used, and you say you use your music to convey messages of brotherhood and personal freedom. That's very interesting. Yes. And can you give us some examples?
Well, you know, of songs. Well, yes, so you know, so all of the songs I think that I do have to deal with relationship on some strata. Could be man to woman, man. It most likely will be man to woman, woman to man. Man to man, man to children, man to family, woman to family. You know, it's about all of the relationships that we are actually living under stress. The natural ones, the natural things that we are related at, those levels, under stress, because that's what's happening to us, is that we're living as naturally as we can possibly live, you know, which means, you know, just getting enough to eat, you know, having a roof over our head, having a bicycle or a car, you know, but a bicycle will do if that's all there is. You know, I mean, this is who we are. As long as we can move and get from where we are to wherever we want to go, there's a level of comfortability in our life. As long as we can eat at least, if they say it's three times a day, at least two times a day, there's a level of comfortability in our life, you know. And as long as we can have the opportunities that everybody else has at the end of this day, that's supposed to be the whole story. I think that personal freedom, especially in this country, means something completely different than any other country that I've been in. Personal freedom to us is a very unique. I would say that probably in this world there's only two countries that are doing this type of experiment called a nation with a constitutional sense of itself, which is not made up of one specific race or one specific culture. There's only two. That's Israel and here. And in both countries, I find that there is part of that experiment is to live together, coming from where you come from, because Jews come from every culture in the world as well. As Christians, as well as people who live in this country. They come from every country in the world. Now, this country, I mean, not just the Christians, but the whole country, housing as many different people as we do. That is the basis of our so-called national psyche, is that we are made up of many other peoples. And in the whole world, those are the only two countries actually trying to do this. Now, I think Israel beats us out in many ways in that they have a strong religious sense, or we believe it's a religious sense, to the basis of their differences, which is called Judaism, you know, in that sense. And that's a basis through which they can communicate with each other about who they think they are, and to contribute to that central place of being. Here we got the word American, and that's our only thing that we can contribute to, coming from all the places we come from. And that's what we're trying to do. And I think that considering what it was when they first wrote that stuff down to what it is today, I have to say we came a long, 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 long way.
Probably with a ways to go.
And with a ways to go, because I think we have to now contribute from that culture we so design we would like to hold on to. You know, we call it Afro-American. Well, then now we have to start acting like real Afro-Americans, you know? And that puts us on that spot that it puts anybody else. We expect that from. And that's our part that we're dealing with in the larger picture of today, is that we have a part to play, too, for ourselves as well as everybody else, as well as everybody else has a part to play for themselves and everybody else in this story. And we're getting into ours now. As well as everybody else getting into this now, because this is the beginning, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me take you back to the 60s, the 1960s, and let me have you also, we're staying in the 90s, but I'd like for you to look back at the 60s. Do you see any parallels consistent with the movement, the grassroots, all of the grassroots movements of the 60s versus the 90s? Do you see any parallels? It could be political, musical, or otherwise.
I think it's totally all parallel. I think they're all continuums, actually. What we started in the 60s is exactly what we're working with today, on every level, political as any level, grassroots as well. I think that the 60s created, in essence, the grassroots approach to our own sense of self, or sense of safety. In a country we're supposed to already be safe in. And that's everybody. I'm not saying that's just an Afro-American feeling. That I think everybody in this country feels that sense of unsafeness, because everybody's been allowed to believe that their culture is the only American, original American culture. That's not really so. That's something we have to overcome still as parts of our psyche as Americans, our overall big psyche, American psyche. You know, we have to overcome our sense of ownership to what we call American. We all own it. Some of us by way of being thrown here by other countries, and others by way of being brought here by those who were thrown here by other countries, you know. So, I mean, we all were thrown here, as far as I'm concerned. And in that we found the opportunity to seek out a different way of doing things. I mean, we may not have had anything to do with the writing of that in the beginning of this nation, but we sure had something to do with the making of it come true, in the building of this nation, you know, in terms of being Afro-Americans and Chinese, or what all of the people who have contributed to the building of America, in my estimation, are truly closer to being the real Americans than those who just put up the money to do it. Because they're gone now. We must say that they have become what you call multinational and left. So we're down to being us now. And this is our biggest opportunity, is to really show that we don't just walk around here being nice to people because we're too scared to be nothing else. We actually do, because we feel that way. And this is our opportunity to bring those people out who are Americans who may not have had the opportunity to march, but totally agreed with those who did, you know, and to show our numbers. That's what Woodstock really was about. It was a show of numbers. It had nothing to do with the music. because most of the people who were on it, nobody ever saw before.
Well, that's you anticipated my next thought, and I want you to talk to us about Woodstock.
Well, that Woodstock to me was a culmination and a beginning all at the same time, and a historical one, which is now written in the books to have really been. It was that way, and it had to happen because the authorities in this country tended now to protect themselves and their wrongdoings by shining a light on any group in this country they would like to shine a light on and make them the radicals for the day. And they happened to so pick our generation to make radicals for the day. And that was the wrong thing to do, because the radicals we were American radicals, if we were radical at all. We were actually American radicals, and that meant that we were fighting for an America they were stealing from us. And so there we are. That was the first original confrontation of Americans who believe they are going to tell everybody else how to be an American, and Americans who believe that they had the right to design the kind of American they wanted to be, considering the rules. You know?
You were there.
Oh, I was
at
there.
Woodstock. Just how did that make you feel? I mean, you're
there
part of the movement.
My original feeling flying over all those people was that I finally felt the biggest relief in my entire life, that we finally made it. We finally are above ground. They cannot hide us anymore. Too many of us to hide now. And that was the point. The point of that happening, and I think what we miss is that the whole idea of Woodstock commercially has been thrown into a light of just being some music concert. It wasn't just some music concert. The whole idea of Woodstock commercially was stolen from Monterey Pop, which was a movie documentary of a concert that was free in California, where a quarter of a million people showed up free. Well, Woodstock became an attempt to duplicate that kind of gathering on the East Coast. And the guys who put it together thought, gosh, we can do this, and we can make some money too. So it was a commercial thing in their minds. However, it didn't turn out to be that, because the people who went to the Monterey Pop Festival free were also displaying their Americana, their sense of what is wrong with our system, their sense of what could be better. And that was part of what Woodstock was from the beginning. Whether the guys who wanted to do it or not knew it, they were tapping in on an American psyche that was in the becoming. And so they set it up for this to happen. When 850,000 people, and that was the real number, over 8 days showed up, they didn't own it. The people who came owned it. And that was what Woodstock was about. It was about sharing a sense of being American for the right reasons.
Do you think, let's come 1995, 1996, the Million Man March, do you think that particular movement was comparable or is comparable to that?
Absolutely, because that's what Woodstock was. It was a shock to those who believed that they could diminish our sense of self. And it was a shock to those who would never expect something like that could ever happen to them. You know, and that's what it has happened. What they never expect to happen, because they really believe that we are asleep still. They believe that the people are, well, I know they know that many of us are awake, and probably they now know it's in critical mass numbers, but they play the game as if we still don't exist, and so therefore they still look like they have control, and the controls they display in terms of having their fingers on are the ones they absolutely do not have their fingers on. And those are the main ones that they need to impress us on, the voting populace, with having their fingers on. It's the ones they really don't. And unfortunately, I think voters are waking up to the fact that they're doing it themselves anyway. It's all a local situation. And the national situation has never been a real national situation. It's never been.
So years from now, when historians look back at the Million Man March and as they continue to write mm-hmm. the history on mm-hmm. Woodstock, mm-hmm. what will be the lesson do you think will be that they'll write on the Million Man March?
I think that at this particular point, many people are writing the history. So it won't be as narrow as it has been, even for Woodstock. I mean, Woodstock is touted in most cases as being the largest music festival that happened in the 60s. Not anything socially redeeming in that it changed the entire world. They don't talk about that part too much. They do mention it in the books of the young kids who go to school today that it changed our nation. They didn't say it changed the world. Changed the world. And the focus on civil rights, the focus on human rights, all came out of Woodstock, as far as I'm concerned. The focus on gray power, the focus on women's rights, the focus on men's rights, all came out at Woodstock. Part of the 1960s, which is very interesting, it's called long hair. Now, what most people don't and probably never wrote about in terms of the social phenomenon that was that long hair came out, and that includes the afro. Long hair came out as a men's movement. It was a men's movement. It was like women came out for the women's movement. Men had theirs before the women had theirs, and they didn't even know it. It was called long hair. Was called, okay, I grew my hair long, and I'm going to walk out in the street, and everybody's going to get on my case. They're going to call me a woman. They're going to call me gay or whatever they're going to call me because I got long hair. But I like it, and I'm going to wear it anyway, and I'll go through it.
I'll conclude my interview with Richie Havens, the late great guitarist, singer, and songwriter in 7 days. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.